So I'm on your email list, and I also just listened to a recent episode of your show that was called 1,000 Statist Arguments Smashed. And
which, by the way, that was a bit of hyperbole. It wasn't exactly 1,000.
Okay, I'm glad you used the word hyperbole, because on the email list, or the emails, which I really enjoy, people are getting smashed there a lot, right? People are getting owned. I could be misremembering, but I think in one email, somebody got decapitated. Did you use that word, or did I make that up? It could have been verbally decapitated, logically.
Yeah, of course. And I think I took that from somebody else, actually. But yeah, all right. But this is all in fun for my inner core of people.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Right. I wanted to ask, though, I just moved to Pittsburgh, and I've been meeting a lot of new people lately. None of this should be shocking or surprising to me at this point, but I've been having some mildly frustrating political conversations in the process of getting to know people. A lot of these people at first are simply baffled by me not being a progressive, you know, and then I have to kind of explain to them that I'm not really a Republican either. I proceeded pretty calmly, and I've often, not always, but often discovered that their political identities are almost entirely driven by emotion, you know. So in this episode of your show, 1236, 1,000 Statist Arguments Smashed, you have some really great rational arguments, right? Where you're talking at one point, I think, about, you know, the history of machine tool technology, making an economic argument. And I'm thinking, like, how far could I get at a dinner table with these people?
Oh, no,
not at all. Exactly. So you have these great rational arguments against statism and against leftism, but very few people out there, they exist, but they're the minority, reason their way into those ideologies. I'd like to hear just a little bit about how you have factored in and handled the volatile emotions, particularly of leftism, in some of your debates or interventions in real life.
Yeah, that's true.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is Monday, September 17th, and I'm very pleased to be welcoming back Tom Woods. One of the reasons why Tom and I wanted to get together today was to make sure that you know that in a month, and it's not too late, you can join us on the Contra Cruise. This is the yearly event for Tom's podcast, his show that he does with Bob Murphy, answering, and yeah, I'm going to say it, smashing the New York Times op-ed column of the Keynesian economist Paul Krugman. I had only listened to the show a couple of times before Tom invited me on the cruise several months ago, but grateful for the invitation, I started listening to the show more regularly, and I definitely recommend it as a way to either learn about or brush up on economics from the Austrian viewpoint. And if you don't like the Austrian school, the Austrian perspective, that's great too. It will also provide you some nice resistance training, you know? That's a fun thing to do. Find some shows you disagree with and listen to them, and then when there's something you disagree with, hit pause and talk to yourself. Now, don't just talk to yourself. Pretend that somebody else is there. Pretend that you're having an argument with another person. And you can do this at the grocery store. You can do this on a city bus. Who knows? I might try it on the airplane when I'm flying to San Diego to meet up with these guys in a month to go on this cruise. But yeah, it's a great exercise. I've talked about doing that for years. Lots of you are already fans of Tom and Bob, so I hope you're checking out this show at least periodically. I found it to be pretty helpful. And because this isn't like something that, you know, I'm super passionate about, the economic stuff, I am a little rusty, admittedly, on some of these concepts. Because the last time I really like hit the books on this stuff, it was, you know, more than 10 years ago when I was first getting into all of these ideas. So Contra Krugman is the podcast, ContraKrugman.com. The website to learn more about the cruise is ContraCruise.com. But I didn't, like I said in the notes there, this is a thinly veiled promotion for all of that, but I didn't want that to be the whole show. So recently I had turned somebody onto Tom's podcast. This guy who doesn't know a lot of the politics or past drama with the Libertarian Party, he said to me, why doesn't this guy seek the Libertarian nomination for president? And I thought that was a wonderful question. And I said to him, you know, I'll get Tom Woods to answer that for you. I know him. He invites me on trips. So that's the second part of our conversation. In the third part, we will quickly revisit, as you heard in the intro there, some of the themes from that Speed and Politics series I did in 2016 and 17. I still have a couple more episodes planned for that series. We talk about Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, And it was interesting to hear Tom's thoughts on reason versus emotion and the interplay between the two. So all of that is coming up on the show today. You know, I just want to mention, too, that if you are one of the people who is supporting this show, either through the AV Club or through Patreon, and you can see all of the options for supporting School Sucks at schoolsucksproject.com/AV, you make this show possible. And not just this show today, like you are responsible for this show existing at this point. I'd like to remind you of that. And I'd also like to add to that, that I'm very grateful. I was recently introducing somebody to the sort of chronology of School Sucks, and we were watching some old videos, like from our live show in 2012 and 2013. And it just reminded me like what we used to have to get by on. I mean, it was 5-6 years ago, but I look at the production value of so much of that stuff, and it's just completely unacceptable. And now a lot more things are possible, including, you know, me being in an amazing city, in a place that I love to live, in a studio that is much nicer. That old studio had yellow walls, and it was in the most dangerous part, or near the most dangerous part, of Manchester, New Hampshire. We could have been murdered any night coming out of there at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning, because we used to be on LRN. We were on the radio from 10 to midnight after Free Talk Live. And then we would do what was at times over a 2-hour bonus show called the After School Sucks Special. So we'd be walking out into the mean streets of Manchester at like 2 a.m. We're really lucky to have survived that. And there was also a graveyard right across the street that was filled with ghosts. So to think about where we were, and it wasn't even that bad of a place, aside from ghosts and almost getting murdered. It wasn't that bad. That wasn't a bad situation. The studio was actually well built and well maintained. But comparing that to where we are now, I'm extremely grateful to all of you. So thank you so much. All right, everybody, here's my conversation with Tom Woods. Check back later in the week for installment number 2 in our cinema manufacturing series. Wow, I never tried to say that portmanteau out loud before. Cinema manufacturing. I like that. That will be along this Thursday. Thanks for listening, everybody, and I'll talk to you again soon. Take care.
So we're doing our next Contra Cruise, which is a cruise that we do that's based on the – it's inspired by the Contra Krugman podcast, but we don't spend a week talking about Paul Krugman. We spend a week surrounded by great libertarian folks. Probably if you've been to a lot of libertarian conferences, you'll see one or two familiar faces, a lot of wonderful folks. We do hilarious and fun things all week. We don't do too many early mornings. I hate early mornings, especially when I'm on a cruise. But the beautiful thing about it that makes me proud and happy is that the company that does this, puts this cruise on for us, is the same company that does the National Review and Weekly Standard cruises. And what they told us is that on those cruises, we get a lot of silver-haired people. By the way, not there's anything wrong with that. I'm coming to be silver haired, but it's a very much older demographic. And they said, whereas your people, I mean, yes, you have a variety, but it's mostly young folks, young couples, young professionals. And we just don't have that demographic on our cruises. And I thought, there you go. There's the future. That's what we're about here. So anyway, it's tremendous fun. And for the moment, that's what I'm looking forward to. But I've got a couple of fun things cooking for 2019, but I can't give them away yet.
I gotcha. So what's a hilarious thing that I can look forward to? Because I am going on the cruise. You said fun and hilarious things. Yeah. How many, is this the third one you've done, by the way?
This is the third one. Yes.
All right.
Well, I'll give you an example. I mean, if people have been to Porkfest,
yes,
they may have done this one in the past. And that is, we play Freedom Feud, but it's like Family Feud, but with libertarian questions. But our libertarian questions are like super specific. So it would be, who's your least favorite celebritarian?
Okay.
I mean, oh boy, you know, only our people would even know remotely what the plausible candidates for that are, much less the real answers. Or, and this was great. Last year we had the comedian Dave Smith, who's wonderful, and Scott Horton, the foreign policy specialist, and they went head to head. You know how Family Feud works, two people at the buzzer.
Indeed.
And the question was given, other than podcasts hosted by Tom and Bob, what's your favorite podcast? And they're both podcasters. So Dave buzzes in, part of the problem. That turns out to be the number one answer. So at that point, he felt like, I win the Contra Cruise. But the Scott Horton Show was also up there on the board. But honestly, and then last year we had Scott Horton. Now, I don't know if your listeners have heard Scott before. But
oh, sure. Yeah, he's been on.
Oh, he's just an amazing resource. And he, I mean, could you imagine the guy, as long as there was somebody who wanted to learn something about anything, he was up talking to that person. He was up till 3 a.m. every single night just talking. We have so many pictures of people huddled around Scott to learn everything they could. But then, you know, he could be super intense, like academic intense. And then we went out on this big zip lining excursion and, you know, he was like a 10-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. And then we do, you know, of course, there's karaoke naturally. And then there's a shipwide karaoke, and our people are always very well represented, even in the shipwide one. The people thought, you know, the fun of this is going to be Bob and Tom will be there and we listen to their podcasts. But the real fun was they met a lot of people, you know, they can stand the sight of. I mean, these are non-annoying people. These are not people who have problems interacting with others or have problems with social cues or some of the awkwardness maybe you encounter in the occasional libertarian event. That's all washed away. And every night, you know, every night you sit with different people, you sit with a speaker every night, and it's just you get to know folks that, I mean, in our group, our Facebook group for the cruise, these people are like lifelong friends now. And
sure.
We had a guy last year came and said, he was in tears. He said, I have never met a libertarian in my entire life. And he spent this, and he's just couldn't believe. He said, "This is the best week of my whole life," and that actually made me feel a little sad. but still, it, honestly, we Bob and I feel like it is the best week of the year. Bob Murphy, my co-host on the podcast.
Yeah, Bob's been on the show in the past too. I met Bob, I think, at Porkfest. We actually one year, Tom, we tried to recreate the interview with a zombie thing with this other podcast. This was Bob's idea at Porkfest, and I didn't know the internet sensation that the whole interview with a zombie thing was. So the podcast was called Wheels Off Liberty. It was a comedy show that ran from maybe like 2010 to 2011. At the time, I was one of the hosts. So they put us up on stage with Bob dressed as a zombie, and he starts doing this shtick, and I don't get it. I don't understand. I missed an amazing opportunity, and I should have been very grateful to be part of this thing. But I knew nothing about it. I'd never seen the video. So I'm just going, Bob, I don't get it. I don't get what I'm supposed to do.
That's right. I think Bob told me about this.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, it's hard thing to do. I mean, for people who may not have seen it or don't remember it, I made that video back in 2010. It's had a lot of views. And the idea of it was that I knew that if I wrote a book on state nullification, people would say nasty things about me, you know, that he favors slavery or whatever preposterous thing it is, just because I like the fact that in 1798, Virginia and Kentucky were ready to tell the federal government to go take a hike mm-hmm. when it was trying to criminalize free speech. So anyway, I wrote a book on that. I find that interesting as a historian. But I knew what the response would be. So I set up this video. It's a beautiful thing about the internet. I was able to do this video, put it out there for free. The idea was Bob Murphy is playing a zombie with a television talk show who interviews authors, mm-hmm. but he can say only one word at a time. For some reason, we gave this ground rule. So I would have these sophisticated answers and drawing on history, and then he would just come back with slavery, you know, whatever,
right,
like all these,
right.
these one words, these, you know, smear words or whatever, just to show you that that's what happens. You have substantive arguments and people just shout some word at you. So that did become a bit of a phenomenon. In fact, I actually bought the domain interviewwithazombie.com because there you can watch the video. And then beneath it, the blooper video was actually even better because it shows all the times I couldn't hold it together because I was laughing at Bob. And then it just became, but the trouble is, I would like to revive it at some point, but it's hard to make it work with the zombie only saying one word at a time. It's hard to – we may have to break out of that. But, and also the other beauty of it is the makeup that we put on Bob is so ridiculous looking. So the next time we do it, we don't want to make him out to be like this Hollywood-style zombie. But half the fun was he looks like a raccoon. I mean, Half the fun is how amateurish it is.
Indeed. Well, no, I mean, you could bring in a crew. I mean, now, you know, you have references like The Walking Dead, Game of Thrones has some undead in it. So you could really do it up. You know, maybe even CGI becomes realistic. But no, I think the white face with the raccoon eyes.
And then it's more like
Heath Ledger's Joker.
We also didn't put in it because Bob, let's just say, is deprived of hair. So the very top of his head, we hadn't covered at all. So when the different camera angles are going, you can see normal flesh color right on the top of his head. But I mean, that's that wasn't really the point. We just had a lot of fun with it.
So when I introduce, this is absolutely 100% true. When I introduce people to Tom Woods, near YouTube anyway, that is the first thing that I show them. Not even the interview with the zombie, the blooper reel. I say,
have seen the bloopers, yeah.
Absolutely. See that first, I say. But that's what I show people. And it's actually an interesting segue that I'm about to make. Could you just give the dates for the cruise? There are still tickets available. What's been the attendance in the past couple of years? And what are you like shooting for? What do you find is like a good number?
Well, first year we did it, you have to go with the understanding that people are going to say to themselves, I think I need to wait to see the proof of concept on this one before I
get
the old checkbook
sure.
out. So, but still, I mean, we had, probably 80 people on the first one, which the cruise company was absolutely delighted with. I mean, it was highly successful and profitable for that matter. Then the next year we had probably close to 130 or if not more. So it was, just going great guns. This year we're likely to be back closer to the first year. And the main reason for that is we had to reschedule the cruise, which is just, I mean, you can reschedule something that takes a half an hour of somebody's time, but to reschedule a 7-day thing when people only have certain weeks earmarked for vacations from work. But the reason we did it was that we found that our cruise that we had hoped for last year coincided with the Libertarian Party convention.
Mm.
And we knew a lot of people would be going to that. And secondly, we were supporters of the folks known as the Mises Caucus of the Libertarian Party. And we felt like every single ad we would do for the cruise would be undermining them and their efforts. And we didn't want to do that. So we had to chuck that. And by that point, finding a cruise that still had conference space available was very hard. It took 3 months of delays till we finally were able to announce a replacement. And those were the critical 3 months, because that's when people are arranging their vacation time for the year. So that meant that the growth that we've had, all right, it's going to be halted a little bit so we take a little bit of a hit, but we felt morally obligated to do that, even though it does, it did hurt us a bit. But the concept is still great, and we have a ton of people. We have a nice mailing list of people who want to keep joining us in the future. So, it'll be fine. There's no problem.
All right. So you actually mentioned something there, and the dates again are the 21st through the 28th of October.
Yes, 2018. Right.
All right. So you mentioned something there that kind of leads us into our next topic. First of all, introducing people to Tom Woods and the party convention. Right. So I recently turned somebody on to your show who was fairly new to the ideas of liberty. But I said, this is really, if you want to engage with what's going on in the world in a responsible way, you should be listening to Tom Wood's show. This person started listening. And after a couple of weeks, he asked me, so why isn't this guy trying to be the libertarian candidate for president? And I said, wow, that would be when you set aside a day, I could explain to you maybe that whole story. But if somebody finds you and they understand that, you not only embrace but promote day in and day out the ideas of liberty, and you talk about these political issues, and you talk about, you always have your fingers on the pulse of current events, why wouldn't this guy throw his hat in the ring to be the libertarian candidate, especially when it has been so difficult? So this is like a very novice level of understanding here, but especially when it has been so difficult for the Libertarian Party to find a good candidate, why not Tom Woods?
I think there are a few reasons. First, family-wise, I've got 5 daughters, and
right.
This just would not be fair to them. And then my first obligation is to them. Secondly, it would just be a nightmare. I would have half the party establishment actively sabotaging me. There's no doubt about that. They would rather see the whole thing burn down than me be successful. Thirdly, because I don't have name recognition, there's no way I'd be able to match Gary Johnson's vote total. So they would take that as the so-called pragmatists would take that as vindication of their view. Oh, well, see, we have to nominate former Republican governors after all. There's no way I can match that. So I would be just walking into a trap right from the get-go. And it would just be constant. I mean, the smears would be out of this world unbelievable. And people say, oh, don't worry about that. We'll answer those. Do you really want to spend your whole life defending 2 sentences from a book that I wrote 12 years ago? I mean, is that what you want to devote your life to? I just can't think that it is. So I would rather be the guy who is secretly in the background helping the good guys. If they want help with speeches or press releases or whatever, I'd be glad to be your unpaid intern if you think it would help. But I don't think I'm the guy.
Let's go back to reason number 2, why you wouldn't do this. And you say there are people who would rather burn the entire party down than tolerate you being the nominee. Now, people in your audience certainly understand this, but there's certainly a lot of people in my audience who don't. So why is that? Who are these people? And what is their objection to you?
Well, there are a couple of different possible ones. I mean, one would be that I'm going to be uncompromisingly radical. But and they say, but that's not going to get votes. What we need is votes. And the thing is, I understand that to some degree that is what a political party is after. But given the reality of the situation that you need 70 million votes to win, and at this stage the Libertarian Party is highly unlikely to get 70 million votes, then you may as well use the platform to – I mean I wouldn't be the guy who would be saying, you know, let's get out there and privatize the military and try and persuade – you know, hundreds of millions of people of that. I mean, I'm not a complete dolt. I would, you know, I think I'm reasonably good at looking at the audience I've got and explaining what I believe in a way that resonates with them.
Right.
And that's how I've been able to convert a lot of people who were conventional, you know, Republican Party people. Because when I was younger, that's what I was. So I know what their concerns are. I know how they think. I know how they talk. I can talk in a way that resonates with them, and they say, well, you know what's okay. So this guy, if I came in there and sounding like a commie or something, they wouldn't give me the time of day. It's because I can sound like them that I get their guard down, and then I use that capital that I built up with them, and I'm able to change a lot of their minds. And so that's something that I can do. I would not just be throwing, you know, rhetorical bombs everywhere and just letting the chips fall where they may. I would basically pick a few key issues, hammer those home. And then if people do ask me follow-up questions, I'm going to give them honest answers. I'm going to be a Ron Paul in that regard and not worry about focus groups or what, you know, what my campaign people are telling me. I would hope I'd have campaign people who would tell me to just go out there and be honest. But there are people who think that's reckless, that we need to just, you know, more or less be the candidate that you know, wants fiscal responsibility and, you know, wants to cut down on the wars. And the problem is Republicans sound – that sounds like a Republican. It sounds like a Rand Paul-style Republican, except at least Rand Paul has a snowball's chance in hell of winning. Whereas since the Libertarian Party doesn't, why would you vote for a guy who sounds like he's just part of one of the wings of the Republican Party? Why would you do that? What possible reason?
Exactly. So, I mean, one of the reasons why it was actually like, even though I know all the answers to the question this new person asked, like why you wouldn't do this, it was still a compelling question, right? Like there was a real chance to spread these ideas in 2008 and 2012 as faith went down in the two established parties. I remember 2016 being a particularly bad year for faith in the parties. And, you know, 2020 is right around the corner. And I'm kind of wondering what's your understanding of what the party wants? Because they must see this. It's going to be Donald Trump on the Republican side. And I'm sure they're going to find, you know, the sort of equal and opposite response to that on the left. There's at least going to be those people in the candidate pool. Maybe they go with the safest choice, as they always do. But it's going to probably be someone undesirable. And again, libertarian ideas, not the Libertarian Party, but libertarian ideas have a great opportunity to get traction if they have the right messenger. And the party has not found the right messenger. I mean, what happened in 2016 with the Libertarian Party, I thought was absolutely disastrous. It was a time when so many people, I think, were hungry for something different, and that different thing wound up, you know, having to be Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump. So because the Libertarian didn't offer a compelling story. So what do you think the party is after? Like what's their goal? It's obviously not to win the election.
No, but I do think that a lot of the folks, again, not everybody, but I mean, I joined the party this year because for you know, a variety of reasons. But I do think there are a lot of people who think, of course, we can't win in 2020, but we can grow. And by grow, I think we have different understandings of the word grow, because by grow, they mean get more votes than last time. And by grow, I mean get more activists in the party who are going to do the grunge work and spread the word about the party and be active in it and, you know, get the work done that needs to get done. Just getting a lot of votes from people who show up, vote, and then we never see them again. Well, that's not nothing, but you can build up the actual party, I think, more effectively when you have a candidate who actually really excites and inspires people, excites them. That this is not just another stuffed shirt. This person believes in something. And I feel like it's not to say that Gary Johnson is a horrible person. I don't think I'm being unreasonable to say I and again, I don't want them to be able to caricature me. I'm not saying you need to have a PhD in economics or something to run for president. But I am saying you have to be at least – you have to be in love with the ideas the way you and I are. I mean, yeah, you have to believe in them. You have to be dying to learn more about them so that when 4 years later we see you again after you ran the first time, you've got 4 more years worth of reading and study and rhetoric under your belt. And that was not the case at all. It was the same totally uncurious person again 4 years later. And yeah, meanwhile, during those 4 years, was there any event that took place where people said, I wonder what Gary Johnson's view about this is? No, but not even his own supporters were asking that question.
Right, indeed.
There's a problem there. There's a problem.
Now, the chairman of the National Committee, Nicholas Sarwark, who's somebody who I know there's been some tension with between, you know, you and I know you didn't create it. And, you know, it certainly wasn't even really two way. But one of the things that he said, and again, I know you've talked about this on your show quite a bit, but my audience, but there's a lot of people in my audience who are mostly unfamiliar with this story. One of the things that he said that I actually found kind of compelling, even though there's lots of problems surrounding this, was when he was criticized for trying to make the tent too big. He said, we're trying to get people in however we can, and I don't understand why people feel like they need to be guardians of these ideas as if they're fragile. Like, you believe in these ideas. Like, kind of going back to what you were saying about, you know, loving this, wanting to learn more, being curious. He was speaking to, you know, the convention audience and saying, you're passionate about this. You believe in this. Who believes that this philosophy is so fragile that if we expand the size of the tent, it's going to erode the ideas? So I thought that was like, I mean, I disagree with that guy on most things, but I thought that was an interesting statement, right? And this has been kind of the tension of making the tent. And I don't like there's lots of things that have happened, like in the Free State Project, as far as trying to attract people into that movement, and the Libertarian Party, where I think this diluting is going to happen. Where are you on that as far as expanding the tent?
Look, I'm not trying to fan the flames of that.
Sure.
You know, disagreement that I have with him. I'm really not looking to bring that up or get involved in that. But as long as you ask, the problem that I have primarily with that statement is that I don't get why expanding the tent involves kicking out a lot of the good folks. I mean, implicitly kicking them out. Hmm. I mean, the campaign that he more or less was running against me and against Jason Stapleton, another libertarian podcaster, in which he basically said he had Jason Stapleton had him on, defended me completely, and then at one point the chair said, well, but maybe your audience, meaning Jason's and presumably mine, is not really what we're going for. But what? The only group – we actually have read all the libertarian classics. We can defend every libertarian position. We worked our tails off for it. We're not the natural constituency of the party. Like, we're not the bedrock of the party. So it seemed to me like of all people to gratuitously go after – he was going after me, and there might even have been a swipe against Bob Murphy, if I recall. And I don't know that was another guy in the LP. Mm. But the point, I mean, who the heck doesn't like Bob Murphy? What kind of deranged person?
Yeah, insane people.
He's about the nicest guy in the world. So I would say, before you talk to me about your glorious plans to expand the party, how about calling off the civil war you more or less launched against people who were just classical libertarians?
Now, what is that? For why do they want people like that exiled from the party? I mean, there must be a reason. There must be a vision why they would think people who are more on the Mises caucus side are dangerous or even a liability to the party in the future.
Right. Now, they're trying to say, well, we're associated with some sinister people and ideas. And then when you actually look at the specifics of what they're claiming, it's in every case some kind of a distortion, and in some cases just made up altogether. So they're trying to claim that there's some kind of alt-right connection, which is – when I listen to the alt-right talk about economics, it makes me want to set my hair on fire.
Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
I think this is – I mean, tomwoods.com/episodes. Just look through. I've got over 1,200 of them. I've talked to every libertarian you can imagine across the whole expanse of all the different parts, and I get along fine with them. There's almost nobody, really, in terms of a big name, who has a serious problem with me, like, we got to keep Woods out of here. I've spoken at too many conferences, been invited to do too many things. I've published too much. That's just not plausible. I frankly think there are people who want the party to be palatable to the press and the establishment. I mean, why else would you court a Bill Weld?
Sure.
You want to be respectable to the press and to the establishment. And the press was very kind to Bill Weld. There was no Bill Weld is a crazy extremist and you better not pay any attention to him. I think it's a craving for respectability, but respectability for all the wrong reasons. I'd like to be respected because, well, you know, I may not agree with that guy, but wow, that guy's smart, well-spoken, and has some guts. Actually says something different from what I'm accustomed to hearing. That's where I want to earn the respect.
Yeah, and I wish it's a difficult problem because I wish the world worked that way, where on the national stage with the national media in the mainstream political scene that you could earn respect that way. I almost think the party, I hate to say this, and I wish it was some other way, is onto something, that the message has to be as safe and as watered down as possible. So, especially the political left and the mainstream media can't level all these charges of things that I don't understand why are still powerful labels, right? Misogynist, sexist, racist. Yeah.
But on the other hand, look, I mean, they said all those things about Trump. And
right.
He had every obstacle placed in his path and he had no political experience and he still won. So though just the I mean, look, the fact is, if you're against Obamacare, they're going to call you a racist.
Right.
You
know, yeah, that's it. That's what I'm saying.
Well,
yeah.
We'll just be super sweet and kind and then the media won't call us those names. Well, I think they were nice to Weld partly because they thought he might take votes against away from Trump. So I think he got a little bit of a pass. But there are way too many social media threads out there. Just go over to Facebook and see what people say about libertarians. They think we're fascists.
Right.
And they don't think we're fascists because of white supremacy or any nonsense like that. They think capitalism is like fascism. Yeah. You know, when you're faced with something like that, instead of trying to coddle people like that, you got to write those people. There are some people who need to be written off. I mean, the Democrats don't try to get every single vote they possibly – they write off some because they only have so much energy, so much time, so many resources. You have to go to people who aren't going to be swayed by these magic words, this one word that's supposed to shut down all discussion. There are some people who are sick and tired of that. You go for those.
Exactly. You know, that's actually – that's a good transition into our last question. So I'm on your email list, and I also just listened to a recent episode of your show that was called 1,000 Statist Arguments Smashed. And
which, by the way, that was a bit of hyperbole. It wasn't exactly 1,000.
Okay. I'm glad you used the word hyperbole, because on the email list or the emails, which I really enjoy, people are getting smashed there a lot, right? People are getting owned. I could be misremembering, but I think in one email somebody got decapitated. I think did you use that word, or did I make that up as a?
I'm not sure. I use it to describe anything. I might have been describing somebody else's performance.
It could have been verbally decapitated, logically.
Yeah. Okay. Of course. Yeah. And I'm not. I think I took that from somebody else actually. But yeah. All right. But this is all in fun for my inner core of people.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Right. I wanted to ask though. I just moved to Pittsburgh, and I've been meeting a lot of new people lately. A lot of these people have been women, and I've been having some. Mildly, I mean, none of this should be shocking or surprising to me at this point, but I've been having some mildly frustrating political conversations in the process of getting to know people. A lot of these people at first are simply baffled by me not being a progressive, you know, and then I have to kind of explain to them that I'm not really a Republican either. I proceeded pretty calmly, and I've often, not always, but often discovered that their political identities are almost entirely driven by emotion. You know, so in this episode of your show, 1236, 1,000 Statist Arguments Smashed, you have some really great rational arguments, right? Where you're talking at one point, I think, about, you know, the history of machine tool technology, making an economic argument. And I'm thinking, like, how far could I get at a dinner table with these people? You know, exactly. So you have these great rational arguments against statism and against leftism, but very few people out there, they exist, but they're the minority, reason their way into those ideologies. And I'd like to hear just a little bit about how you have factored in and handled the volatile emotions, particularly of leftism, in some of your debates or interventions in real life.
Yeah, that's true. Well, of course, sometimes talks I give have different goals, you know, than others. So some of them are intended just to help people who agree with me defend themselves more effectively, or simply to help them understand the situation better. Because our folks are extremely curious, because we're not generally driven by emotion. We generally want to understand the world. And so sometimes I'm just giving them, well, here's the information, here's how I understand it, here's what I think is going on. Right. And yeah, that's not intended to go much beyond our precincts, but it still has a role. But now, it's true what you're telling me, and I've resisted this for years, because I want to believe that reason can do it. Because if we're really waging a genuine battle based on reason, then right. I think our odds are pretty darn good.
Mm.
But you're right that reason, and I hate to admit this, I really, really hate to admit this, but reason so often seems to be an ex post rationalization for things people have come to believe for other reasons, on other grounds. And some of them are indeed emotional. And if not irrational, then non-rational, let's say.
Well, this explains Trump perfectly, right? You know, like I think he looked at this and he completely understood that people will – you're familiar with Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow?
No.
Where – all right. So this is a great book that was actually – I think Kahneman was a behavioral economist, or is a behavioral economist. And he wrote this book about two thinking systems that people have. So system one is this fast, like survival-based, biologically driven system, like making quick decisions that are often emotional. And system two is slow thinking, right? Thinking that is deliberate, that is rational, that is more critical in its process. Now, humans have both of these systems, but people can be very triggered to use system one. And through system one, they make a decision, right? That decision is a snap decision. It's an emotional decision. But people know that that isn't really like satisfactory. Like everybody knows almost instinctively that that is not satisfactory to be like, I don't know, because that's how I feel. I mean, you can get people to admit that if you kind of bear down on them a little bit. But most people usually have some kind of rationalization behind that. So the idea is that system two kind of backfills what somebody has already decided for emotional reasons, whether
yeah.
it's, you know, resentment or fear or hope, something that isn't rational. But then, the brain kicks in and says, or the front of the brain kicks in and says, look, we need to do better than this. We need to kind of like at least come up with some kind of justification. That's the idea. And I think Trump took advantage of that. Trump went after people's emotions, but he gave them – he just kind of sprinkled behind it enough like, oh, yeah, I think immigration, build the wall, that kind of thing, jobs, bring coal back. You know, he gave people like talking points to justify the decisions based on emotions they had already made.
Right.
Now, of course, the left has mastered this and Trump kind of imitated that.
That's right. That's right. I would say, for example, when it comes to protectionism, almost nobody – who's defending it has actually sat around saying, I'm going to read everything I can by economists on this and try and figure out what the real truth of the matter is. Now, it's that they already think they know that, well, we're getting taken advantage of and it's a war out there and we've got to levy tariffs. And this is the one case in the world where I think taxes make you richer.
Right.
Every other time I'll say taxes make you poorer. These taxes, however, these taxes will make me richer. I don't think that's because they've sat down and read academic papers. And I'm not saying that, you know, that reading academic papers is always necessarily the best way to approach something. But I just mean they're basing this on something that their gut is telling them.
Yeah.
Their gut is telling them that they need the tariffs, or their gut is telling them a lot of this stuff. And so Trump did not sound like somebody who read or wrote white papers on subjects like this.
I agree.
He sounded like a guy who was going to get out there and – yeah, I know that's the least controversial thing I've said. But he sounded like a guy who was going to get out there and I'm here to fight for you.
Right.
That was what they heard him say, that you are the forgotten man of William Graham Sumner. I'm here to fight for you. And these people, this whole establishment, all of them together, they have betrayed you. And I'm here to fight for you. That was the message they got. They didn't need, well, 4.7% increases in tariff rates result in X number of jobs in one ear and out the other. So he had that kind of a connection with them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that certainly helped propel him. See, the more the establishment was against him, the more they were proving his point. I couldn't believe how blockheaded they were in the way. I thought, are you trying to help him? This is his whole narrative, that the establishment is against him. And every time you ban him from something, you know, you try and shut down his supporters or whatever, you're just feeding into the story he's telling. It's like he's paying them to act this way. I could not get over – or the way the left would have these disruptive protests where Trump couldn't speak or something like that. I thought, It's like he must be paying these people. Either that or we're dealing with the dumbest, the single dumbest political opposition in the world. You're feeding into the story he's connecting to middle America with. Duh.
Yeah.
So now the question is, how do libertarians compete in a world like this? And the thing is, when you read Mises, Ludwig von Mises wrote a book called Liberalism. And of course, he means in the old sense of liberalism.
Right.
But in there, he has this passage where he says, look, liberalism doesn't have the flags and the songs and you know, all this irrationality. We have reason and ideas, and those are going to take us to victory. And that's really sweet. You know, I love that. In principle, who could object to that? But in practice, is that in the world of ideas, maybe that happens. I mean, just the other night, I've been in New York and I went to the Soho Forum, which is a monthly debating society where you have a libertarian against somebody else, and everybody is very polite and respectful. And sometimes the non-libertarian wins the debate. I've seen that numerous times. Mm. It's declared the winner by the audience. That this person at least made me think, or I'm unsure as compared to where I was before. That does happen. I mean, that happens out there in the world. The Yale Political Union is an amazing place.
That's right.
In fact,
yep.
I saw you there, right? Yeah. Remember we did that interview afterward.
Yeah.
That was amazing. I mean, we had people with a lot of different points of view arguing a controversial question and people really sitting in there and learning something. That can happen. But in politics, this is the thing. It's so poisonous. It's so poisonous. Because you cast your vote. And it's not like you're voting for which television to buy or which smartphone to get. I mean, there you put a little research in, or which car to get. Well, I'm going to be stuck with this car for 10 years maybe. I sure better look into which one's the best. But with a politician, you don't really get the immediate – I mean, your vote isn't really going to make any difference anyway. So people just – they vote on the basis of, you know, again, their gut, or this guy has a lot of yard signs, so I guess my neighbors like him. In other words, they vote on grounds on which they would never make any other decision. Certainly, they'd never make any consumer decision. And
name recognition, maybe.
Politicians are fine with that. Yeah, name recognition, I suppose, would be one thing. But so it is hard. But on the other hand, there are features of the libertarian message that – I mean, if Trump is going to go around saying, look, these people are screwing you, boy, can we say that in spades, right? Not only are those people screwing you. Even Trump is screwing. I mean, like, it's worse than you think.
Right, right.
You know, because his solution is, well, I'll get in charge and I'll make sure that these kind of oppressive things are done by different people. Well, that's – I mean, come on. We can come up with a better message than that. But that was how Rothbard thought. I mean, Murray Rothbard wrote all these scholarly books and articles. But then he would write very, very, you know, rhetorically punchy journalistic style articles or editorial style articles where he would say, look – I can make all the arguments in the world against agriculture subsidies, but the fact of the matter is, what it boils down to is, you are getting ripped off by people who go around, people who think of themselves as superior to you because of the degrees they have in some heaven knows what field, and these people spend all their time thinking of ways to fleece you and rip you off, and that's going on every day, and you know, whatever. I mean, if you can talk that way. And it doesn't have to be policy wonk, policy wonk, policy wonk type talk all the time. You can reach something that's quite visceral. And this doesn't have to just be a right-wing appeal. You can also, as I've done, you can make quite visceral appeals when you talk about the warfare state in the U.S. And that also reaches some reachable people on the right wing, because there are some people on the right wing, of which I was one, who do actually have some kind of fellow feeling.
Yeah,
absolutely. For other human beings. And when you say, step back for a minute, forget Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives. And this is what I did in Los Angeles in 2011. I was in a group. I had a lot of veterans and conservatives in that group. I said, I want you to forget all the labels for just a couple of minutes. And I want you to think about what you in this room have been led to support. You supported a regime that was keeping, and then I listed a whole bunch of necessary, essential goods out of Iraq. And the result was, well, some people dispute the 500,000 dead children. Okay, let's say that's a 90. Let's say it was only 10%. Only 50,000 children died of malnourishment and complications related from the fact they didn't have water treatment facilities and all that. Now, there's no reason for that. That did not in any way hurt the regime. They're fine. So that was just gratuitous wickedness for no reason. And yet, I bet a lot of people in this room thought that was the right thing to do. Now, if that had been the Soviet Union, we'd say these people are butchers. Look at how they treat kids. But it's not the Soviet Union. It's your gang. And because it's your gang, you're going to get the pom-poms and do the cheers. But wait a minute, aren't you also the same people who tell me I shouldn't be a moral relativist? There are some moral principles I've got to just believe in. Well, how about not gratuitously starving children?
Right.
And yet this poison of politics and of us versus them has led you to support that. And I am telling you right now that you are better than that, that that shouldn't have happened. And I did reach some of those people because I got a standing ovation from them after that. And I had people coming up to me and saying, that gave me the chills. And I'm going to have to think about this. I thought, okay, that's all I'm asking.
Oh, absolutely. It certainly worked for Ron Paul with enough people, you know, even though the Republican establishment really hammered him for it in 2008 and again in 2012. But to the bigger point that you were trying to make, let's actually cliffhang it with this and we'll pick this up. Maybe we could do a part two to this conversation in a month when we're together. You know, you talked about Trump's message, right, which was basically a photocopy of the left's message, probably going all the way back to the New Deal. You are the downtrodden. Do you know you're the downtrodden? Do you know you're the disenfranchised? Do you know you're the victimized? And we're here to help. That has been the left's narrative for a long, long time. And Trump said, oh, that looks like it's pretty compelling for most people. I'll use that. The problem with the libertarian message there is that what always comes at the end of it is, and I will use the power that you finger quotes give me to fix it, right? People keep going for that emotional argument. But libertarianism or a libertarian candidate or even somebody just trying to promote these ideas along those same means, they hit a wall there, right? Because they can't do that. They're not looking for, that level of power to fix these things. I mean, it's really demagoguery that I think no libertarian candidate, if they're adhering to the principles of liberty at all, they're not going to go that route that you're tired of getting screwed and I'm here to use my power to stop you from getting screwed in the future. I think that'd be a very hard message to craft in a libertarian way.
Well, it depends on what you consider to be getting screwed. If getting screwed is inexpensive imports are making it difficult for you, then yeah, you're right. We can't compete with that. But I don't want to compete on that level.
Right.
But moreover, I think we can do it because the I would just frame it as you are getting screwed, but it's by the very people who say they're protecting you. It's
yes.
The very people who say it's these. I would actually have maybe a graphic with all the different federal agencies. And there are hundreds and hundreds. And you never even heard of some of these. You say these people, it's a swarm of locusts. They're here in Washington because this is where the money is. And this is where the power and the influence are. And look at the statistics on unemployment here versus the rest of the country and salaries here versus the rest of the country. The head of the empire is doing very well. And
right.
this is where blood-sucking parasites tend to congregate. Well, you know what? I'm here with a blowtorch, okay? and they're going to have to go find honest, remunerative work and instead of just sucking the life out of our country. And then I would have visual aids. I'd say, you know, a lot of you people believe that our economy has been deregulated. All right. I just, in one of my email newsletters, I put a little chart of the number of pages in the Code of Federal Regulations, and it goes back from 1950 to the present, and it shows each year the number going up and up and up and up, and it's so astonishingly high now compared to 1950. And you'd say, you know, you'd think with all this fancy education, these people would be able to read a simple chart, but since they can't, I'll read it for them. This is the opposite of a deregulated economy. Nobody can move. You can't do anything.
I mean, right.
Constant problem. So I would say, look, if these are the people who are supposed to be helping you, they're stymieing you at every turn, and they're doing everything they can to make entry-level people unemployable. And they say, oh yeah, we're just here to help you. Yeah, we're here to make you completely unattractive to an employer, completely. So you'll never get a chance. And that's why teen unemployment has been a problem. It's why black teen unemployment has been a problem. I mean, I would just hammer and hammer and hammer at these people and say, you know, what they want to do, what they thrive on is turning us against each other, because as long as we're fighting against each other, they continue with their salaries for doing heaven knows what all day.
Indeed.
Their power, their influence. As long as you and I are fighting, as long as we're fighting old people against young people, blacks against whites, rich against poor, city versus country, south versus north, whatever it is, that's what they want. And I say, you know what? Let's do the opposite of that. Let's all of us say, you know what? Hey, we're Americans and we're all in this together. No matter which one of those categories we fall into. Yeah, there is an us versus them, but it's not you versus your neighbors.
Right.
It's us versus those who live off your labor. and it's time they were put in their proper place. I think you could say that as a populist libertarian message.
Absolutely. And I that was actually one of the reasons why I fell in love with the city, Pittsburgh, that I moved to, right? Because it reminded me of when I was little, growing up in New Hampshire, how people prioritize community over – like everyone's attention has been sucked into this political world over which they have no control because of things like 24-hour news and social media and those echo chambers. None of that existed when I was growing up or when you were growing up. So it was like there wasn't always that gravity of that world where we can do nothing, having all our attention and emotion sucked into. Now, you know, people will tell you, like, if you support Trump, I don't want to date you. If you support Trump, I don't want you in my tennis club. Like, that world, because of the, I think largely because of technology, has spilled out into, you know, a lot of like face to face eye contact communities. But when I grew up, community, that was the priority. It seemed like, you know, my dad was the chairman of the school board. He was wicked conservative. And it was in a town where there was a lot of people on the left. But people understood that community was the priority over those political divisions, that working together to make that little town better, to maybe even make the state better, was more important than this kind of political tribalism that's really spun out of control, I think, in the last 5-10 years. So I think that's a good point. Tom, I want to be respectful of your time because I know you're in New York and you've got a flight to catch. And I would happily continue this conversation with you in a month on a ship if you'd like.
Absolutely. We've recorded numerous podcast episodes on these ships, so that'd be a lot of fun.
Oh, absolutely. I'm planning to do a whole bunch of recording there. So can you just plug your website and your podcast for my audience?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the podcast, subscribe over at tomwoods.com/iTunes. And then check out, I'm kind of well known at this point for my free ebooks, but they're really good on a lot of topics. So tomsfreebooks.com, where I've got Bernie Sanders is wrong. And then I take on in other ebooks a lot of the hard questions we have to deal with, like what about education? What about healthcare? Wouldn't people just be dying in the streets?
Right.
I've dealt with all that stuff at tomsfreebooks.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Tom. And I'll see you in October.
See you soon, Brett. Thanks.